The U.S. froze military aid to Ukraine this year. Multiple news outlets now say President Trump personally ordered that freeze days before his phone call asking about political dirt.
How's this all look in Ukraine's capital? I'm Steve Inskeep with David Greene, and this is Up First from NPR News.
The president spoke of rejecting globalism the last time he addressed the UN.
The United States will not be taken advantage of any longer.
So what to expect in 2019?
Also, a network of torture survivors is trying to hold the Assad regime to account in Syria. Their work has led to the arrest of a Syrian military officer.
He's the biggest fish arrested in the West to this point, anywhere in the world to this point.
Could their efforts lead to government officials prosecuted for war crimes? Stay with us. We'll guide you through this day's news.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from SimpliSafe, a wireless home security system with video verification technology that can help police get on the scene faster. Get free shipping on your system and a 60-day money-back guarantee at simplisafe.com/NPR. Support also comes from Honest, committed to better-for-you organic options for all. Honest products are fair trade certified, and when you choose to drink an Honest beverage, money goes to fair trade certified suppliers to help support their communities. Visit honesttea.com/podcast to learn more.
Let's hear from a country that has been a special focus for President Trump.
Right, the country is Ukraine, to which the United States froze vital military aid. Now, President Trump also had a phone call with Ukraine's new president. Trump acknowledges seeking dirt on a political opponent, Joe Biden, though he insists he was speaking against corruption. The Washington Post and multiple other news outlets now come close to connecting these events. They quote senior officials who say the president personally ordered the military aid withheld at least a week before his phone call to Ukraine. In Washington, Democrats are increasing their calls for impeachment.
There is a lot to discuss here, so let's go back a few years and also go over to another continent here with NPR's Lucian Kim, who's in Ukraine's capital, Kyiv. Good morning.
Good morning, Steve.
How are Ukrainians responding as more is known about Trump's actions?
Well, unfortunately, Ukrainians are very used to corruption scandals and are also used to their prosecutors doing almost nothing to go after corruption. In fact, that's one reason why Volodymyr Zelensky, who's a professional comedian, was elected president this year. It was a protest vote against the old way of doing business. Hmm. As for Ukraine being in the middle of this partisan scandal in the U.S., I think it's unpleasant to say the least. People here see the U.S. as Ukraine's most powerful ally, and it puts them in a very uncomfortable spot to be in the middle of this political firestorm. I've tried speaking to people. Ukrainian officials are not really commenting on this. They want to wait until their president, Zelensky, meets President Trump tomorrow at the United Nations.
And when you say most powerful ally, we should note Ukraine's neighbor Russia has attacked the territory in various ways, and that's why Ukraine is relying on U.S. support. Now, how did Joe Biden, or rather his family, get involved in Ukraine at all?
Well, Joe Biden's son, Hunter Biden, showed up pretty much out of the blue in 2014 and joined the board of an energy company run by a former environment minister. Now, hiring Hunter Biden, this was at the time when they were also hiring a former president of Poland to the board, was part of an attempt to give this company some respectability. There were a lot of questions about its owner, this former environment minister. He was being investigated for money laundering, and there were questions about how he obtained his drilling licenses. So the accusations of wrongdoing actually predate Hunter Biden, and hiring him was actually part of this sort of cleanup effort. What frustrated Western countries, including the U.S., and many anti-corruption activists here in Ukraine, was that prosecutors were not investigating this company or basically any other wrongdoing in the country.
Well, what drew then-Vice President Joe Biden into Ukraine?
Well, Steve, the first thing to understand about Joe Biden and Ukraine is that as vice president, he was the Obama administration's point man on Ukraine. He often visited, and it was really part of his brief to monitor the reform process that was supposed to be going on here. Now, the accusation we hear is that Joe Biden tried to use this position to somehow protect the energy company where his son was on the board. I asked Brian Bonner about that. He's the editor of the Kyiv Post, Ukraine's English language newspaper.
Joe Biden, as vice president, did not try to kill the investigation into Burisma. In fact, one of the reasons why the prosecutor general was fired was because he obstructed one corruption case after another. He prosecuted no one for corruption. He protected corruption.
So, you know, Biden's pressure to fire this prosecutor was really in line with what other Western governments were demanding at the time.
Well, we should emphasize this then, since President Trump faces questions about his conduct and he says, no, actually, the problem here is Joe Biden. Is there any evidence that Joe Biden, as vice president or otherwise, did anything improper?
Well, here in Kyiv, nobody is saying that. The fact that he was pressuring Ukraine to fire this prosecutor was the U.S. government's position, as well as that of other Western countries. One anti-corruption activist here in Kyiv told me Ukrainian reformers were actually thankful for that pressure and that this kind of carrot-stick approach was the only way to push reforms.
Lucian, thanks for the insights. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
NPR's Lucian Kim is in Kyiv. So how does all of this look to the White House? Let's go to NPR's Franco Ordonez, who's traveling with President Trump, who's in New York today. Franco, good morning.
Good morning.
So what is the president saying to justify his various actions here, and especially that phone call demanding information about the Bidens?
Well, he's been extremely emphatic that he did nothing wrong, but he really hasn't been able to get away from it, even trying to get to New York. You know, in Washington, pressure continues to build. Seven freshman Democrats who are also members of the military, they wrote an op-ed last night in the Washington Post saying that if the allegations are true, they represent a threat to what they swore to protect. You know, as I said, he's been very emphatic. He teased us reporters that he might share the transcript, but he stopped short of doing it, saying that he would do it. He just says it sets the wrong precedent for the calls. We've heard that kind of thing before, I am sure, based on the new reports that we'll hear about it again today.
So stay with us, Franco, because, of course, the president has a big appearance in New York, where you are today. He speaks before the United Nations General Assembly.
That's right. And U.S. presidents have often used this speech as a way to emphasize America's leadership role on the global stage.
This great institution must work for great purposes, to free people from tyranny and violence, hunger and disease, illiteracy and ignorance, and poverty and despair.
We can choose to press forward with a better model of cooperation and integration, or we can retreat into a world sharply divided.
It is entirely up to us whether we lift the world to new heights or let it fall into a valley of disrepair.
Trump's address at the UN this year comes against a backdrop of a trade war with China, also insecurity in the Persian Gulf, and, of course, calls for stronger action on climate change.
Plenty to talk about, Franco. So what will the president say?
Well, the president and his staff are being a bit coy about his speech. White House officials say the president will present the U.S. as an alternative to authoritarianism. They'll probably discuss respect for independence of individual members, particularly on national security issues. I was among reporters when he was asked about Iran. That will certainly come up. This is what the president said.
A lot of things are going to happen. Let me just put it this way. A lot of things are happening with respect to Iran, a lot more than you would know, a lot more than the media knows, but a lot of things are happening. Okay? I'll be discussing it a little bit tomorrow.
You know, Trump got a boost from Germany, France, and the UK last night. They released a joint statement also blaming Iran for the attack on the Saudi oil facility. President Trump also said yesterday that he's going to talk about the U.S. economy and the global economy.
All right, let's face it. The president, of course, is still a very powerful figure, president of the United States, but also a very unpopular figure globally. Do world leaders still listen to what he has to say?
Well, world leaders certainly listen, but they won't necessarily follow. The reality is American global leadership isn't what it used to be. I spoke with Ivo Dalder, who formerly served as the ambassador to NATO. This is what he said.
Woody Allen once said that 80% of life is showing up. The Chinese are showing up in places where the United States used to show up. And as a result, the Chinese are gaining influence.
The reality is president has pulled back in many ways. He's pulled from the Paris Climate Accord. He promised that he wouldn't be president of the world, and we're seeing that.
Franco, thanks.
Thank you.
NPR's Franco Ordonez is in New York City today. A trove of documents in Europe has become evidence against the government of Syria's Bashar al-Assad.
Yeah, these are documents from inside Syria revealing abuse in Syrian prisons. Lawyers and survivors collected these papers, and NPR has gained access to them. Some cases against the Syrian government are now getting to court in Europe. Many of the hundreds of thousands of refugees who've arrived there bring personal stories of the torture they survived.
NPR's Deborah Amos has seen the evidence and talked with witnesses, and she's on the line. Deborah, good morning.
Good morning.
Where do you go to see this evidence?
Well, to get into the offices of the Commission for International Justice and Accountability, or CIJA, you have to agree not to say where the office is.
Hmm.
It's a security issue. These are experienced war crime investigators, and they are storing evidence, 800,000 documents, 3.5 tons of paper, all of this official documents smuggled out of Syria over 8 years of war.
Wow.
This February, this paid off. They were part of why the German police arrested a former Syrian intelligence officer who'd slipped into Berlin with refugees. Now, there's going to be a trial, and Bill Wiley, who's the Canadian investigator, he founded CEJA, he says international justice is based on what's called linkage cases.
Because international criminal justice is focused on higher-level perpetrators who normally don't get their hands dirty. Those who are known to the public appear in impeccably tailored suits, speak fluent English in the case of President Assad. Ultimately, those are the guys that we're after because they're most responsible for the offenses.
Oh, you say linkage cases because these people might not personally have killed someone and yet they are participants in or even directing the effort. So you have documents that you've seen relating to these cases, also survivors, right?
Yes, and many of these people are becoming witnesses, and it's restored some hope considering what they've been through. In 2011, there was an uprising. The Assad regime responded with violence, and then they had sweeping arrests. Tens of thousands of people were jailed. They say tens of thousands, and there are documents to show this, were tortured to death. Omar al-Shoghri is someone I talked to. He's 24 years old. He was arrested when he was 17 years old. He endured 3 years in two of the worst prisons in Syria.
You can't ask me how many thousand times I want to die, but I never want to see how they kill me. I want them to kill me like fast. Mm.
But they didn't. He survived. His mother paid an intermediary $20,000 that it saved his life because it got him out. He's now on a mission. He's talking to Swedish war crimes units. He's talking to German prosecutors. He is helping to build these cases against Assad.
Do some of those cases go forward?
Well, last year, the French and the Germans issued arrest warrants for senior Syrian officials. There's this upcoming case in Germany, and what I am told by lawyers and the CEJA people is there's about a dozen mid-level Syrian officials who are in Europe. These are the most promising cases because there is documentation, there are witnesses in Europe. There's 13 European states who are moving on these investigations, and I'm told that they expect more trials to come.
Although I have to ask, is there any chance that a Syrian official is going to be brought out of Syria and into a French or German court?
If they stay in Syria, no. They are immune from arrest. But in a way, what the prosecutors, the lawyers, the witnesses say is the effort sends a message. For one thing, it encourages prosecutors to open more cases. But as important, it gives Syrian survivors a way to be heard, to testify in open court. You know, the experience of torture is a loss of control. They have control back. It's almost like a therapy. They want to sign up to become witnesses.
Deborah, I want to circle back to something you said at the beginning. You said the documents that you viewed are in a hidden location. They're in hiding. I would imagine some of the people you talked with are also being quiet about their exact locations. Are they in danger, even though they're far beyond the borders of Syria?
You know, I can tell you that Omar al-Shoghri is concerned about his security. He has been threatened on the telephone. Sweden is so open that you can find anybody's address online. They're all supposed to be there. So you have to ask if you want yours to be private. He has just gotten that. There are plenty of Syrian intelligence officers in Europe. And those witnesses who have family in Syria or even refugees in the surrounding countries, that's where their families ended up, they won't testify. They're afraid. There is still fear that the long arm of the regime can reach them all the way to Europe. So the people who are testifying, other Syrians think that they are the most brave, the most remarkable people to bring these stories to the open.
I'm just trying to get my brain around the idea that European justice cannot reach into Syria, and yet Syrian power potentially can reach into Europe.
Playing by different rules. That's what these trials are about.
Deborah, thanks so much.
Thank you.
That's NPR's Deborah Amos. And that's up first for this Tuesday, September 24th. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm David Green. We hope you come back here with us again tomorrow. You can subscribe to us wherever you listen to your podcasts. And if you've got a minute or two, we'd love it if you would rate us and review us on Apple Podcasts.
Thanks for waking up with NPR News. Remember that your NPR station makes Up First possible every day. You can support them and support us by going to donate.npr.org/upfirst.
No matter where or when your day begins, start it with Morning Edition from NPR News, on demand, weekdays from 7 to 3. Just say, Alexa, play Morning Edition.